From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll speak with Milwaukeean Antoine Carter about his long career in leaving things better than he found them. Then we'll explore the Great Lakes with photographer David Zurich.
All of my work really represents, I guess, excuses to go have adventures. And one of the things about this particular project is I came away realizing that I had just as big an adventure along the Great Lakes as I've had in any other place in the world.
Plus, in a new Bubbler Talk, we'll learn about a plane crash that happened on Milwaukee's Jones Island in the 1950s.
Back in that day, if you hear sirens all over the place, there's something happening, yeah? So we got in the car, headed down to Jones Island, saw the thing. It's one of the last memories I have of my dad.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Imagine a vacant lot. Do you see overgrown weeds, maybe some stray trash that blew in from the wind? On these sites, Antoine Carter sees opportunity. Carter has a long career in leaving things better than he found them. He started by turning vacant lots into community gardens, then helped turn dozens of blank building walls into murals, and he's currently the director of philanthropy at the Milwaukee Public Library Foundation. Carter's also featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine for his plan to build apartment buildings on vacant lots near Milwaukee's Moody Park. He joins Lake Effect's Sam Woods to talk about the plans and his work, starting by explaining what gardening taught him about opportunity.
The very first project I worked on was in my neighborhood. We took a vacant space that had a lot of bad energy. Someone was murdered on the steps of the house that was there. And to create that level of positivity out of a very negative situation and a negative space really inspired me to make that kind of a part of my mission as a person getting into this work. And so I was able to do a lot of amazing projects alongside residents in Milwaukee, and people who hadn't known each other, who were unhappy with what they saw in their neighborhood and who came together to improve that space. I think for me, that was something that I got hooked on very, very quickly and easily. And it turned from 40 gardens to 60 to 75 to, I think about the time I was done, there was over 100 community gardens, pocket parks, orchards, art spaces on vacant lots in the city. So something I'm very proud of.
I'm wondering if you, when you look back at these, all of these vacant lots that are now, you know, community gardens partly by your hand, what is your feeling as you pass these lots, knowing the history that came before it and your hand in creating this future?
You know what? When I drive past projects, I think of the amazing people who led them. So the care in which someone took to even vision about what this would look like. So I think about all the residents who their sweat equity continued to push along the things that I just helped start that were ideas that they had anyway.
So moving forward in your professional development, soon mm-hmm. after focusing on turning vacant lots into community gardens, you were involved in turning blank building walls throughout Southeast Wisconsin into murals.
Yeah.
So is the through line here between gardens and murals as simple as I just like beautiful things and I want more beautiful things in the world? Or is there more to it than that for you?
I think step one would be I personally only want to do dope things. But I would also say, two, yeah, it was an evolution. It was how can I continue to leave things better than I left them? And so I got connected with an artist named Stacy Williams Ung, who was working on a project that was up and coming, Black Hat Alley. And so I was able to manage that for 2 years. Like working with community groups, you help them vision what the space would be. And I did that, did kind of the same thing just with municipalities or business improvement districts, and worked with them to create a thing and identify how we could make it the dopest thing possible. So I feel like everything had the same sort of process. And luckily, I was available to highlight the skills that I learned at Crown Work and kind of just replace vacant space with wall and community garden with art. And it was a lot of the same things. And it was people who were unhappy with what they were seeing.
You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Sam Wood, speaking with Antoine Carter. And if you've been listening for a few minutes, you may think that I'm here to list the most comprehensive resume in Milwaukee, and you'd be forgiven because I'm going to introduce yet another pillar of your work, Antoine, fundraising. Yes. So you're currently the Director of Philanthropy for the Milwaukee Public Library Foundation. So to start, can you just unpack what this role is about?
Yeah. Most people do not know what the Milwaukee Public Library Foundation is. And so I would say what taxpayer dollars covers is amazing buildings, awesome librarians, heat, electricity, rent, delicious books, and everything that is essentially above and beyond that is mostly covered by private dollars in a public-private partnership, and the foundation leads the private side. And so we have our own board. We are a 501c3, and our goal is to support 90% of the programs hosted at our 13 branches that cover children and adult literacy, workforce development, technology and maker spaces, art and culture, environmental sustainability, and economic development. And so my job is to make things easy for whoever is interested in supporting the library.
Is there a project or library initiative that stands out that you want to highlight of like, yes, we made that happen, or we, you know, this, you know, this is an example of what the Milwaukee Public Library Foundation can bring to the world?
Oh, I would say makerspaces. Makerspaces off the top of my head.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Our neighborhood branches are actually very in tune with what the neighbors needed. And so as the library, because they're a separate entity, as they started to renovate past branches, this idea of a makerspace came out. And there are currently three, but there will be four maker spaces. The first one is in the Mitchell branch, and that kind of started. There is a demo kitchen with a coordinator who facilitates healthy eating programming, as well as a music studio and computers so that young people can write their raps and make their beats, use a computer to make their cover art, and get a delicious, healthy snack as they do all that. And that idea has spread through other library branches. Washington Park has more robotics-related programming and amenities. Good Hope has a CNC cutter and a 3D printer, an ode to the industrial area. And Martin Luther King, our newest branch, which will be coming very, very soon, we'll have a makerspace as well. So super excited about that. My childhood branch was Martin Luther King. So it has been an honor to be a part of a group who helps make that space even more inspirational and connected to the community.
Yeah. So catching up to today, you are featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine in part because of your plan to turn vacant lots near Moody Park into apartment buildings. So really straightforward, tell me more about this plan.
So honestly, it started with me coming to a realization that I drive through Milwaukee and you see skyscrapers in one area being built and you see nothing but maybe liquor stores being rebuilt in other neighborhoods. And I no longer want to be a person on social media posts just writing words. And so really thinking about how I could benefit my city in a new way. Building buildings seemed like a very logical step in kind of starting from vacant lots, working on walls. And so I know there are thousands of vacant lots in the city, and I know that the potential of Milwaukee is really heavily set in those spaces, because what else can we make better, right? Those are all open canvases to beautify in all sorts of ways. And so for me, just leaning into the skill set I have and kind of growing up and seeing my best friend's grandma's house get torn down and seeing my other friends' family's homes get torn down and nothing happening after, and 10 years passes, 15 years passes, 20 years passes. I don't want it to be 25 years, 30 years. And rather than putting the onus on someone else to do it, I looked at myself.
So I can't help but notice we've returned to vacant lots here, whereas, you know, a decade ago it might have been turning vacant lots into gardens. Now we're trying to turn vacant lots into homes. Do you have any idea of timeline for construction? Because, you know, there's building a garden bed, right? And then there's building a home. Any idea when we should start seeing some movement on this?
My goal will be next year. A lot of behind the scenes stuff is happening right now. Trying to get numbers and words as fine polished as I can get. And I've had a lot of amazing partners and mentors and advisors who are really helping me, as this is my first project. However, for me, It's a passion project, because I've grew up in all these neighborhoods and have hung around. So for right now, it's a lot of pre-development stuff, architects, engineers. The goal would be to fundraise over next year, and then hopefully by the end of next year, start to have shovels in the ground.
So I want to end on a pretty big question, but first I'll say that I've only lived in Milwaukee for about 8 years now, but a consistent conversation that we seem to have is how to keep people here. You know, how do we make Milwaukee a place of opportunity? And when I look at you and I hear you talk about turning vacant lots into gardens, turning blank building walls into murals, finding money for makerspaces, turning vacant lots into homes, I see someone who doesn't need to be convinced that this is a place of opportunity. You're seeing opportunity in a vacant lot, right? So help me be as convinced as you. How can I see the city differently? How can I find potential in the everyday?
You know what? I talk to people. I talk to a lot of residents. And what I learned is that there are a ton of people who care about our city and want to make their space as nice as they can, with hopefully thinking that the critical mass of everyone else will do that and it will make the city better. There are a lot of my friends who have struggled with the evils of the world who talk to me about how they want to seek more purpose in their lives and contribute in a more positive way. I have a lot of friends who have done bad things and now want to buy homes and improve the neighborhoods that they help deteriorize. You see young people who, from my perspective, aren't provided with a lot of opportunities to find their purpose. And so we see a lot of things happening. So for me, I think Milwaukee can only do better. I think we can only get better because those people, if we can finally find something to provide purpose and provide something for them to feel positive, to feel like they're contributing to the greater good. The people are there who want to do it. And so providing people with things to do, not busy work, purposeful programming, purposeful activities. Milwaukee is too gritty and too creative. Everyone loves the hustle and they want to be a part of it and they don't know how. And I think if Milwaukee could find more ways to provide that for people, the possibilities are unlimited.
That was Antoine Carter, Director of Philanthropy at the Milwaukee Public Library Foundation. He spoke with Lake Effect's Sam Woods, and you can hear their extended conversation at WUWM.com. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you listen to your podcast to download and listen to us on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about a plane crash that happened on Jones Island in a new Bubbler Talk. But first, we'll explore a new book of photography featuring the Great Lakes. Keep listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Photographer David Zurich grew up in a small town along Lake Huron, where he spent his formative years on the beach, learning to ski, skate, and swim. Zurich left the Midwest to study geography in Hawaii, which then led to his career as a photographer traveling all around the world. Recently, he decided to turn his lens back to his roots along the Great Lakes for his new photography book called The Third Coast. There are over 100 images in what is kind of like a photo tour of Lakes Huron, Michigan, Superior, Erie, and Ontario, from unbroken horizons of water and sky to coastal hometowns and remnants of industry. To share more about what went into this book and the places he captured, Zurich joins me now. David, welcome to Lake Effect.
Oh, it's my honor to be here. I'm glad to be and talk with you and see what's going on here about the Third Coast and other things.
Yes. So you've traveled a lot as a photographer and studied in Hawaii, and there's a big difference between our personal ocean versus living actually by an ocean. So when did you learn to kind of see the uniqueness of a freshwater Great Lake?
Really, the uniqueness, I guess, came after moving away from the Great Lakes. You know, living so close to a place, it just becomes a part of your everyday existence. And, you know, I always appreciated it, but I didn't necessarily dwell on it or think about it too much in sense of uniqueness. It was just part of an ordinary life that I was living. But as I moved away from the Great Lakes and I would go back and visit the Great Lakes, you know, I was always kind of confronted with the scale of the horizon, the scale of those lakes. The spaciousness, I guess, is what I really came to appreciate about those Great Lakes.
Your photography book, The Third Coast, exploring all of America's Great Lakes shoreline, really just highlights that vastness. And as a photographer, you hadn't yet explored the Great Lakes as a subject to work with. So what brought on or inspired this project?
I was in the middle of a project. Actually, much of my work is in Asia, in India and in the Himalaya region. I was in a middle of a project in India, and COVID and the pandemic shut down international travel. So I live in Kentucky now, and I was kind of spinning my wheels here, thinking what I was going to do, wondering how long this was going to last, you know, as we all were. And then I decided that I would basically make an exploratory trip up to the Great Lakes to see if there was a photography project there. So I went to the hometown, the place where I grew up, and I visited family there and started wandering up along Lake Huron, you know, with my camera, making images, And slowly it dawned on me that this would be a great project, and it turned out to be a wonderful project. So really, it's the COVID and the pandemic shutting down international travel that was a specific trigger for this particular project.
And this book is divided by seasons, and each season kind of focuses on a different Great Lake. So can you share a bit more about the logistics of how you planned out your photography road trip, essentially?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, all of my work really represents, I guess, excuses to go have adventures. And, you know, one of the things about this particular project is I came away realizing that I had just as big an adventure along the Great Lakes as I've had in any other place in the world. And that was a wonderful realization towards the end. But at the beginning, I hadn't really thought to compartmentalize things by even lakes or seasons. I went up to Lake Huron and I was traveling along the Thumb area, which is a very familiar ground for me. It's kind of home ground for me, and starting to make images. That was in the fall. And you know, fall has this kind of melancholy atmosphere to it. And I was, a lot of memories were coming up as I was recalling my youth, traveling with my family along the lake. My folks were all up from the Thumb area. That's where they came from. So we'd go up and visit family up there. And so there started to kind of develop in my mind a sense that I could distribute my work across the lakes by season. And when I started thinking in those terms, how it would line up a lake with a season, Lake Huron was the first one that happened to just be coincidentally the autumn when I was up there. But then I was thinking, okay, Lake Superior, it had to be winter, you know, so that really kicked it off. And I went up to Lake Superior in the winter months and photographed up there, and then things kind of lined up after that.
And the images in your book go beyond simply lakeshore scenes, right? There's also photos on land, kind of speaking to the interplay of lakes and the agriculture or other human elements and industries around them. A lot of seasonal aspects, of course. What in particular would meet your criteria if it was a scene not immediately by a lake? What captured your attention that wasn't a body of water?
All of the images in this book are all made on the lakeshore or within a couple of miles of the lakeshore. So there's going to be some spatial interaction, some geographic connection between that landscape and the lake. Oftentimes, though, what is interesting is as you drive through the countryside, at least for me as I experienced it, driving through the countryside just a couple of miles from the lake in farm country. And again, my family grew up as dairy farmers up on the Thumb. My mother, for example, had very little interaction with the lake, even though it was a couple of miles away. And the same is true with my father. I mean, they were busy on the farm. My dad didn't even learn how to swim, for example, even though he lived a couple of miles away from it. So I guess in a way, partly it was the linkage between what was going on a couple of miles from the lake and the lake itself. And partly it was a realization that there was a bit of a disconnection here, even though geographically these were really in the same spot, the same corridor, a couple of miles apart. But there was really a spatial distancing between people's lives and the interior. So in that way, I wasn't trying to purposely make connections between an interior image and the lakeshore. They just kind of fell in line as I was pursuing these lakeshore routes that I was traveling on.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about a few photos highlighting industries built along the lake, starting with the photo of the iron ore dock on Marquette Bay. Can you describe that picture?
Yeah. And again, some of these, the one you mentioned, for example, is a perfect example, but some of these have very, very direct linkages. So the iron ore dock, you know, this is the iron ore that's mined in the interior of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan in this particular case. And it's shipped then to the docks and loaded onto freighters and then, you know, basically shipped around the world. So this was a winter shot. This is the old dock. They've got actually a new infrastructure there to handle some of this kind of big work now. But I was wandering around Marquette Bay and I saw that dock from various perspectives. It wasn't really until I started walking towards it that I saw the geometry. So I guess what drew me to that image, or at least making that image, was really the geometry involved. And then there was a small, tiny little window-like opening at the end of that dock that looked out onto the vastness of the lake, a tiny little thing that you're looking through. So that was what was of interest to me, I guess. It was a geometric kind of compositional thing.
Yeah, a lot of these images just fall into place so nicely. And I think another example of that that's not centered around water is the photo of Hiawatha National Forest.
Yes. So Hiawatha National, this was actually very, very close to the lake. Again, I was on a hiking trail, but I had snowshoes on. So I was snowshoeing through the forest. And partly the link between that forest and the lake was really Lake Effect, given the name of your program here. You know, that snowfall that we find so heavy along that lake shore that's coming from the moisture from the lake itself is just dumping on this forest. Partly with this image, it was just the quietude of that place. I mean, it was so quiet. The snow on the ground was muffling all the sounds. You just had the flurries dropping down through these trees. And I was trying to quietly walk through it, I guess, and be there quietly. So that's the quiet of that image is what was most compelling for me.
While you capture a lot of beauty, certainly, you also captured challenges that face the Great Lakes regions, such as algae blooms, there's agricultural runoff, or abandoned houses, abandoned businesses. Why was it important to show both sides of this?
This is a great question. It really gets at the heart of my work. I don't do a lot of nature photography. I don't take a lot of what I would think of as kind of the classic pretty picture. I'm really interested in photographing places that connect in a certain way to human society. That includes how we have transformed places. So I'm really looking at the landscape from a cultural landscape point of view, not a natural landscape point of view. And even more than that, I'm looking at the landscape as kind of a reflective surface, a mirror, if you will, of the lives of people who live in that place. And so, you know, we imprint ourselves in these places where we live, and some of it is intentional and some of it is unintentional, but it is still reflective of who we are as individuals and as a society. So that really gets at the crux of the photography that I enjoy doing, is to have the landscape be a palette, not in terms of natural processes, such as a natural landscape photographer might do, the beauty of a place that's rendered by natural processes, but a place that is rendered by human and societal processes. And this doesn't always end up being a beautiful place. It's always an interesting place. And with the right kind of composition and light, it can have its own form of beauty, but not in a picturesque way, I guess I would say.
So if someone's paging through this for the first time, they're not from the Great Lake region, what do you want people to take away and know and appreciate about our Third Coast?
One of the things would be the diversity of it. You know, a lot of folks being in Milwaukee, and I'm from hometown in Lake Huron, we take a lot of this for granted. So one kind of audience would be the people who live in the Great Lakes region, who really interact with these lakes on a personal basis frequently, maybe even on a daily basis. But seeing them perhaps in a little bit different way through my eyes. I mean, as a photographer and as an artist, I have my own vision and image, which is different than anybody else's, but it's an opportunity to see a place through another person's eyes, which can be illuminating. For folks who aren't from the Great Lakes region and who may have very little knowledge about these lakes, yes, they're beautiful places. Yes, they're large places, but they're incredibly diverse places, and they're important on so many levels in terms of the resources they provide, certainly water, but other kinds of natural resources, in terms of their recreational potential for people. You know, so it's really getting at these lakes as a geographic component of the larger American landscape. And it's a place that a lot of folks, frankly, in the United States aren't that familiar with, even though they've heard the name before.
Well, we certainly are fortunate to be so near a Third Coast ourselves. And David, I want to thank you so much for telling me more about your photography, exploring all the lakes beyond Lake Michigan.
Well, I appreciate it very much. It's been a pleasure talking with you. And yeah, I'm a big fan of the Great Lakes. Sweet Mother Michigan, Father
Superior, coming down from Mackinac. David Zurich is a photographer, and his new book is called The Third Coast, America's Great Lakes Shoreline. You can check out some of the photos we talked about at WUWM.com.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM's Sam Woods. This week on Bubbler Talk, we're investigating a plane crash from the 1950s and its connection to the annual Air and Water Show. It all began on a foggy morning on August 5th, 1959. 8-year-old Jeff Taylor watched as smoke billowed from a barge near Jones Island.
Back in that day, if you hear sirens all over the place, there's something happening, yeah? So we got in the car, headed down to Jones Island, saw the thing, and it's one of the last memories I have of my dad. I mean, he died 8 months later, so it's kind of a milestone piece of time in my history. So,
but as time went on, Taylor had trouble finding people who even remember the crash.
Everybody looks at me like I'm nuts when I talk to them about it. People that have lived here all their lives, and you know, they look at you funny. I said, no, man, there was a plane crash. Hit an old ship. The guy died.
So Taylor reached out to Bubbler Talk, asking us to look into it. He remembered the type of plane and that it happened around Jones Island in the 1950s. So, with that information, I started digging in newspaper archives and found the crash he was talking about. Here's what happened. A thick morning fog blanketed Milwaukee on that August morning when suddenly an F-89D Scorpion, a type of military fighter jet belonging to the Wisconsin Air National Guard, came screaming down from the sky. The pilots were experienced. Colonel Seymour Levinson was flying the plane, and he was one of the founders of the Wisconsin Air Guard and a veteran of both World War II and the war in Korea. His co-pilot and radar observer, Lieutenant Robert Goem, had logged over 1,000 flying hours. Bill Stryker, president of the Friends of the Mitchell Gallery of Flight Museum at the Milwaukee Airport, says, given the fog, the two likely thought they were much higher above ground than they really were.
Probably was the result of an instrumentation issue. In other words, the altimeter on the airplane was giving Colonel Levinson false altitude readings as he was approaching the airport for landing from the north. And he approached over the harbor, and I think witnesses claim that he was flying very low over a couple of cargo ships that were unloading in the harbor at the time.
The plane crashed into a barge near Jones Island, killing both Levinson and Goem. The resulting fire brought crews from all over the city to put out the flames. Like 8-year-old Jeff Taylor, Bill Stryker also remembers visiting this crash site as a child.
My father, I think, drove us down to Jones Island just to, you know, rubberneck and see the site. And I just remember the barge that was tied up that was struck by the airplane, and there was a large hole in the side of the barge.
But the next day, both the Milwaukee Journal and the Milwaukee Sentinel labeled Levinson and Goem as heroes. While the crash caused much commotion, it is speculated that Levinson knew they were going down and swerved to avoid both a densely populated Bayview and a cache of flammable gasoline on Jones Island. Crashing into either of these targets likely would have meant far more casualties. Taylor remembers hearing rumors of heroism even that day.
Guys steered the thing into this ship to avoid the plane crashing into all the oil tanks down there in Jones Island and probably take out half of Bayview along with it. So I'm 8 years old, that's superhero stuff. Yeah.
And today, when driving to the Mitchell Airport's departure and arrival terminals, you can see an old B-25 bomber on your left. This aircraft is partially a memorial to Colonel Levinson.
And in 1964, the aircraft was put on display as a memorial, and it was dedicated to not only the Milwaukee Airport namesake, Billy Mitchell, but also to Colonel Seymour Levinson.
But this is not Levinson's only lasting impact on Milwaukee. He also played a role in Milwaukee's long history of military air shows. In 1949, 10 years before the crash and 4 years after the end of World War II, the Air National Guard hosted an open house. This included a mock battle staged to simulate an invasion of Milwaukee. The Milwaukee Journal reported on what to expect.
Milwaukeeans will have a chance Sunday to see their city attacked and defended by air. The attack early Sunday afternoon will be by B-26 bombers and F-51 fighters from the 176th Fighter Squadron in Madison, according to Lieutenant Colonel Seymour Levinson, Deputy Group Commander.
The event invited the public to listen to battle communications on radio and watch the National Guard fight in the sky and on the ground. The Milwaukee Journal hints at the popularity of this kind of event more than 70 years ago.
About 10,000 visitors are expected to attend the open house, Colonel Levinson said.
And one of these was a young Bill Stryker. When I went to him for help with this bubbler talk, we ended up solving a mystery in his personal life as well.
You know, in our early conversations, seeing the date for this mock air battle in November 1949, I happen to remember a family photograph in an album of me at an air show that my parents had dated on the back, November 1949, and I could never figure out why I was at an air show in Milwaukee in November. And now I know.
Stryker says the event is part of a long history of military air shows.
Military air shows, I think, have probably existed ever since military aircraft began appearing in the skies around the United States. I believe the military feels that they have to give the taxpayers a look at where their money is going and to show them what kind of equipment they're flying to defend the United States. I think people enjoy seeing that. I think there's a certain segment of the population that just loves to see that type of thing, see the latest equipment. And then there's also an element of patriotism where people come out to support the military and see what they're doing and learn a little bit more about what they're doing.
Military air shows remain popular today. The Navy's Blue Angels recently performed for part of Milwaukee's annual Air and Water Show, drawing a crowd of thousands over the weekend. For 2 days, Milwaukee's lakeshore was dotted with groups of families, friends, in lawn chairs with drinks and snacks in hand, ready to take it all in. And when I asked them why they were there, almost everyone I interviewed cited reasons of patriotism, continuing family traditions, or just a desire to see cool planes do cool things.
What brings you out here today?
See some kick-ass military planes.
I couldn't tell you the first one I went to, but it's been a lot of them, so it goes back a lot of years.
Once some of the planes start flying overhead here and they surprise you and they come like out of the blue, it just, that tingle just gets me so excited. It's kind of like the thrill of amusement park rides, but for a couple of hours.
No, it's a privilege to be an American, and I'm glad that they are part of the military protecting us.
Specifically, wanted to make sure that my son got to see some of his favorite planes. What are your favorite planes?
The Warthog and the F-35.
You know, I think that the people that have the complaints, if they came down and watched, you know, what we're seeing in front of us right now, that might change their attitudes a little bit.
However, not everyone I talk to is on board. Ekene Ikegwani, member of the Milwaukee Anti-War Alliance, notes that he understands the appeal, but says shows like this are designed to boost recruitment by making war look cool.
They're doing cool tricks. It's fun. You know, you like to see them flying around at high speed and doing like dangerous stunts. But basically what they're doing is they're painting this image in the like the minds of like youth, teenagers, young adults about like, you know, you can do this. This is fun. And like the way you do it is by joining the U.S. military. And then when they're in the U.S. military, they're not always doing these like super cool stunts or whatever. You know, they're fighting wars or dropping bombs on other countries, on innocent civilians.
Ikegwani says this kind of propaganda can be powerful precisely because it associates the military with fun and excitement, and this strategy extends beyond air shows, including one of his favorite movies from childhood.
Same way that like, I have childhood memories of like watching Top Gun, and that's like a fun movie where they fly planes, but it's also that's a real military base that exists. Those are real people that are fighting in wars and doing all this stuff.
Just as in 1949, military shows remain popular in Milwaukee. Though Colonel Levinson is rarely named, his memory lives on, both in the lives he likely saved on that foggy August 1959 morning and in the popularization of military air shows in Milwaukee. But for Stryker, Levinson is one of many Milwaukee-area pilots, both military and civilian, who should be recognized for their contributions to aviation history.
Something that I've begun to realize over the years when I've been involved with the Mitchell Gallery of Flight Museum, and that is the breadth of involvement that people from this particular geographic area of Wisconsin have invested in the history of aviation. You know, the notable names and the technological improvements, things that have occurred all the way back to 1919, Lawson Airliner, Hamilton Metal Plane, astronauts, Jim Lovell, Laurel Clark, various aviators like Maitland and Mitchell, Dale Kreitz. There's a whole host of people that are involved, including the only Tuskegee Airman that was from the state of Wisconsin who flew as a Red Tail in World War II, Alfred Gorham from Waukesha. All of these names should be raised up to the public so that they're aware of the heritage that exists here in this area, and I hope that the museum here at the airport is able to educate people about that.
For WUWM, I'm Sam Woods.
Support for Beltway Talk comes from Educators Credit Union. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit WUWM.com/Beltway Talk to submit your question.
We'll take one more break and then learn about the origin story of Fleet Farm and Farm and Fleet, and learn about the perceived rivalry of the two brands. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Fleet Farm and Farm and Fleet are among the most beloved brands from Wisconsin, and with good reason. Where else can you buy an enormous bag of circus peanuts, a new pair of jeans, and a baby chick all at the same time? But there is a persistent myth plaguing the legacy of these two stores, one that frames them as dueling brands forever locked in a battle for dominance. So we're here to set the record straight with Archer Parkett, managing editor of Milwaukee Magazine. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers and begins with the intrigue that surrounds the origins of the stores.
What really makes the legend interesting is how devoted people are to it. So there are different versions of the legend, but the most common that I've heard is that Fleet Farm and Farm and Fleet originated with two different brothers, or at least distant relatives, and that they had both started it together, started it for a few years, and then had some sort of big feud that maybe it was over a girl they both liked, or they had different ideas about the business. And they got in such a big fight that they split it up. There was some legal action involved, and they had to branch out into different parts of Wisconsin and change their name. So that's why we have such similar names, Fleet Farm and Farm and Fleet. The other version of the legend that's most common is that it was a couple who started it, and that the couple divorced, and that they had to split the store in the divorce settlement and had that same name change thing in the end. That myth has been persistent in Wisconsin for the 6 or 7 decades that those stores have been around.
It seems like regardless of the relationship at the center of it, there is this idea that there was this big rupture that caused the branching off of these competing farm and fleets and or fleet farms. The actual story has a lot more to do with tax law than I'd anticipated, but it does include brothers, two sets of them, in fact. How do we come to have this dueling, as it were, farm and fleet and fleet farm?
Yeah, the actual story, strangely enough, the two franchises are quite parallel. Both franchises started in 1955. Two sets of brothers, Bert and Claude Blaine and Stu and Hank Mills. The Blaine brothers, they were in their middle age at the time. They owned car dealerships throughout Wisconsin. And the Mills brothers were much younger. I believe they were in their 20s. They were the sons of Stuart Mills, who had his own auto company as well, selling cars. So what happened in the 50s were there were these very stringent minimum markup laws in Wisconsin. We still have some of those laws, but they're not nearly as strict as they were back then. So back then, retailers could not sell things at much of a discount at all. It was considered unfair. They all had to mark things at the same price. One of the only exceptions was for customers who owned a fleet, which meant that they had five or more internal combustion engines. So the way that was defined, it could be cars, tractors, even a couple of lawnmowers counted. So at the time, the people who had that many engines in Wisconsin were farmers. And so both the Mills and the Blaine brothers realized that they could get around these markup laws by focusing on the people who had fleet cards, farmers. So what they both did was they started their own stores. The Mills brothers started in Marshfield and the Blaine brothers started in Janesville. Their goal was to sell farm supplies to people with fleet cards. So they were offering these goods at just prices way better than a normal store could offer. And it really was sort of a genius idea at the time. And that's where part of the dueling aspect comes into play, is the idea of who came up with it first. Was it the Mills brothers or the Blaine brothers? And once I started to look into it, that conflict goes even further. They both joined the Mid-States Co-op, which was a group of multiple stores with the same business model, ran by a couple called Bob and Jean Kiesow. And to this day, the Mid-States Co-op claims they came up with the idea. So the Mills brothers, the Blaine brothers, and the co-op all sort of at this point lay claim to having come up with the idea originally. But yeah, in 1955, they both started their first store selling to folks with fleet cards.
It's interesting that there are these two sets of brothers who have started stores. There isn't that kind of rupture at the center. And what I found even more interesting is they weren't the only fighting fleet farmers, as it were. There were a variety of them in this state. Do you have any idea how many there were?
There were dozens pushing 70 to 80 around the Midwest in that late 50s, early 60s time. Because it was just such a great idea, because there was no other way to market these discount goods at the time. But yeah, I looked up some of the old documents about some of these places. There was Farm and Fleet Field Service, Quality Farm and Fleet Supply, Dinsmore Farm and Fleet, Steve's Farm and Fleet. They were all over. It was not just the two that have grown into the sort of Wisconsin behemoths.
Well, and that really gets to what they are now. They are these kinds of behemoths. They may have had these, you know, I don't know if you would even call them humble origins, because both of these sets of brothers came from relatively well-off families. But they are, in many ways, the last remaining fleet farm venturers, as it were. Perhaps even more oddly, even though they were competing, it seems like they had a friendly relationship.
Yes, actually. I spoke to some of the folks who still work at those stores. Unfortunately, both sets of brothers have passed on since then. But yeah, everyone reports friendly relations between the families. There's really no one who says that there was any rivalry outside of, you know, the basics of business. In fact, some of the folks who knew the brothers told me that like Bert and Stu Mills were actually pretty good friends. The personal aspect of the rivalry really does not have any basis in reality that I could tell.
Now here's, I think, the final question. Do you think Wisconsinites are ready for the real story of Farm and Fleet / Fleet Farm?
You know, I don't know, because the real story is just not quite as fun as the fake one. My favorite part of the story was talking to people from the stores and just hearing how often people would tell them their version of the legend and insist that it was real. Even people who knew the original brothers, who had been there for decades, would have customers who just would not listen and insist that it was this personal split. I think it's just a great story. It's very unique that we have these similarly named stores that are so well-loved and have such strong fan bases. And I think the fact that there's this legend adds a whole another layer to it, and the reality's a little bit less fun. But yeah, I think once people learn the real story, it actually is kind of interesting in its own way. The way it developed out of these legal loopholes and the way they've grown their business and become this real cultural Wisconsin touchstone, I think.
For sure. Well, Archer, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Great, thank you.
Archer Parkett is the managing editor of Milwaukee Magazine. He joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers back in 2022. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grit Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Mayon Silver, Taryn Powell, and Jimmy Gutierrez from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take us on the go, download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Lake Effect is going on summer break. Next week at noon, you'll hear Possible, an award-winning series on the future of humanity with technology. The following week, you'll hear Call to Mind, which explores the emerging understanding and research on vital mental health issues. Lake Effect will be back with new local conversations on Monday, August 11th. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.